So Tucker going to inbound on the sideline here. DeRozan gets it on the move. I like those inbounds plays that start with the guy deep. And now Snell is in to guard DeRozan. Nice help from Giannis. And they still have time here. Pick and roll. Lowry, tough step back on Brogdon and hits.
Yeah.
That's just a nasty shot from Kyle Lowry. And now Milwaukee is going to be in great difficulty.
I mean, the story of this last minute. It is Milwaukee got three looks at shots, two of which were clean, one of which was not. They went 0-for-3. Toronto had harder looks and made more of them.
That was our Twitter NBA show call as Kyle Lowry iced the game for the Toronto Raptors. It was a bounce back game for Lowry as the Raptors won it 106-100 over Milwaukee to seemingly win game two at home for the 99th consecutive series after losing game one at home. For the 99th consecutive series. In other action, Chicago took a devastating 2-0 lead on the road against Boston in the 1-8 matchup, and the Clippers 99-91 over Utah in a game that they controlled most of the way. I think, though, we got to start with Boston and Chicago because this is quite a calamitous event.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the idea that there was this discussion that the Bulls were the most likely upsetter despite it being a 1-8 because of Boston's point differential and everything else. I don't think any of us expected it to be like this, though.
No, and this was a game, frankly, the Bulls have just looked like a better team than the Boston Celtics. Now, I'm not going to go absolutely completely crazy here.
You're not going to succumb to Zip Sanity?
And the Bulls did shoot 18 out of 35 on twos outside the restricted area. And then they also went a further 10 out of 25 on three-pointers, including Dwayne Wade doing his usual playoff transformation on jumpers these last couple of years. But there's also the fact that it just felt like they were getting better shots. They got some unlikely contributions. Their bigs have massively outplayed the Celtics' bigs. That's where you thought actually the Celtics would have an advantage there. Nikola Mirotic had a nice game. Robin Lopez continues to dominate. They got good minutes out of Cristiano Felicio. And when Bobby Portis was negative 11 in 9 minutes, they went with Paul Zipser at the four, and he responded with 16 points in 29 minutes on 8 field goal attempts. He was fantastic with his jump shot and his defensive versatility. So I don't know. I mean, it's not looking too good. Stevens jacked up Isaiah Thomas's minutes, and although he played well through three quarters, he was completely ineffective in the fourth despite playing the whole fourth quarter. Boston just looking for answers right now. I mean, where can they go at this point?
Well, I wanted to take a quick second to talk about one of the other dynamics. You talked about the big men. Chicago, we wondered about their point guard situation. They have four different bites at the apple, effectively. And we thought, we'll see if they can get, cobble together something. And in this game, Michael Carter-Williams was shaky overall in his very limited minutes. Jerry Grant got yanked pretty quickly after a couple of different things that irked Fred Hoiberg.
Yeah,
but it didn't matter because
14 in 6 minutes, Grant was. Yeah.
But all of that didn't matter because Rajon Rondo had another strong game. Really, you could look at it statistically, but just from a effect on the game, just on a basic eye test standpoint, the player who was so inconsistent, especially in the early part of the year, I thought he's looked better defensively than he did particularly early in the year. And you can talk about the triple double if you want, but I just thought he had a positive impact on the game. And considering that was originally expected to be a black hole for the Bulls, going to that point is a massive upgrade.
Yeah, well, you can't talk about the triple-double because he didn't have one. He was one rebound short, which means he sucked, of course. But 11 points, 14 assists, 9 rebounds for Rondo, 5 steals as well, which were massive. A couple of key ones in the fourth quarter that set up a run out to Jimmy Butler. And he was 5 of 11 from the field, and he had the ball in his hands enough that he had to be guarded. And I think really one of the things that the Bulls thought was that maybe with, the erstwhile three alphas, Rondo, Wade, and Butler playing together, that if they had Nikola Mirotic out there, then maybe there would be enough spacing for those guys to all operate together. And not only Mirotic, but also Robin Lopez, who did have his 5 offensive rebounds, I think all of them in the first half. But Lopez also was 8 of 11 from the field. A lot of those mid-rangers, and that's a shot that he is very, very proficient at. I mean, if you ever see him warm up before a game, he'll hit 9 out of every 10 of those shots, 8 out of every 10 of those shots. So he's pretty money on those mid-rangers when he's got time and space. And, really, the Bulls have just, I think the biggest surprise to me, I know the Celtics have struggled to score some. I guess it's really been a surprise on both ends, frankly. I mean, I thought the Celtics could shut down this Bulls team, that they wouldn't have enough spacing. That hasn't been the case. 25 3-point attempts, shooting 40% is pretty good. And then also hitting mid-rangers the way they did. And then the Celtics shot a poor percentage on threes, 10 out of 33, poor percentage from the line, and just couldn't score then in the fourth quarter as well until the very end.
So now I think we should get into the topic that you broached to me before I turned it to Rajon Rondo, which is what does Boston do from here? Because one of the potential answers, and it was something they tried late in game one and it didn't work, and then in game two, I thought it was even more stark, was the Bulls did not care that Marcus Smart was on the floor and basically just let him do what he's going to do. He ended up 6 for 11. You know, he had an okay game in that way, but it garbled up everything else that Boston wanted to do.
Well, you can talk about the bench, but their bench actually was in the positive. Thomas was negative 20. He was plus 12 in game one, negative 20 in this one. And again, they lost by 14. So they did okay with Smart at point guard. I do agree he was more of an issue off the ball. He was 6 of 11 in this game. He got to the basket pretty well, got some post-ups. But you're right that they weren't guarding him. And this is another one where they're kind of mucking it up and content to let him shoot the occasional three. So that's certainly an issue. I mean, you can talk about adjustments, but Brad Stevens has tried everything. He started freaking Tyler Zeller at center because they're getting killed in the offensive glass in the first half. They actually shut down the Bulls' offensive rebounding in the second half, not really much thanks to Zeller, I didn't think, who had one offensive rebound, and that was it. But so they tried him. He tried going to Jaylen Brown early in the first quarter, and Brown got beat up, had to be taken out of the game 2 minutes later because he had some defensive mistakes. I think he had a turnover. So that didn't really work as he tried to find some more guys, and he had to go Isaiah Thomas, 42 minutes, Bradley, 40 minutes. I guess you could play Al Horford more minutes. He only played 32 minutes, but you know, part of that I think was just because the units when he wasn't on the floor were doing well. Jay Crowder, I mean, he played well, 35 minutes. Amir Johnson basically got the Keith Bogans in the first half, never came back in, and then didn't play at all in the second half. So they're looking for some options here. They went to Terry Rozier, who didn't play at all in game one, to play him alongside Smart, and you could say that actually worked. Rozier was plus 11 to get a little bit more ball handling and penetration on the floor with that second unit. Kelly Olynyk had an okay game. So really, you know, you can't pinpoint one thing that it's been for the Celtics over this period of time, and Stevens has tried a lot of stuff. It's just he hasn't really been able to find something that's worked.
One element that sometimes can be harder to see statistically is that I think Boston's help defense has been very underwhelming in this series, and it also has been helped by the Bulls having better spacing than we expected, but they haven't faced as much resistance in the lane as I thought would be kind of a trademark of this series, just that the Bulls would struggle in that way, and then that could fuel some easier transition looks for Boston. That has not materialized really at all.
One thing I might try is the Bulls' bigs have been very good switching out. However, that's been on a lot of DHOs that occur right at the three-point line, and there's a lot of traffic too. A lot of times, you know, for example, the Celtics will like run a guy off a double screen from the corner up to the top, right? And so there's two guys who are really in help position, and then those two guys who just set the screen, it's hard, for they're kind of right next to each other, and so it's hard to get a pass to those guys. And Thomas has had a little bit of trouble with the Bulls' size on, it hasn't necessarily been a hard trap, but it's been, you know, the big getting up to the level of the ball. I think I might try to simplify things a little bit less of the off-ball stuff, and try to really get Isaiah Thomas screens, high pick and roll, further out on the floor with the floor spread, and really, if they want to bring that big up to the level of the ball, really make that guy get out there and guard in space. I mean, as good as, you know, Thomas is, and, you know, those bigs have been getting out to the three-point line, it always seems like there's too many traffic, too many other guys around Thomas. So maybe just making it a little bit simpler, giving him space to work, and one of Thomas's great skills, I mean, I know he's been great off the ball this year too, but one of his great skills is just his speed in a straight line. So if you can get him either going at a big one-on-one with a head of steam where he can stop and pull up in the mid-range, just kind of set that screen higher when you can, that might help get him going a little bit better. And then I think they really need to try to set up a lot more opportunities in pick and pop for Al Horford. He's just not getting enough shot attempts. I thought that his jump shooting would really kill the Bulls. And so, you know, I mean, I think if you're the Celtics, run a lot of cool stuff and it gets everyone involved, and you don't know exactly where things are coming, except the Bulls really kind of seem to in this series. So maybe it's just more a sense, which Brad Stevens doesn't necessarily want to do, of let's just use our personnel against their personnel. You know, we'll get Isaiah Thomas guarded by Rajon Rondo, whose effort defensively has been exemplary in the series compared to basically the entire last 3 or 4 years. But still, you know, he's 31 years old. Or Jimmy Butler, even, you know, defending way out on the floor, is going to be more difficult for him against someone like Thomas. And then you make Robin Lopez defend in space, a pick and pop with Al Horford. Horford. You know, I think that, for example, the Hawks had a ton of success against Lopez's similarly slow brother, Brooke Lopez, by getting Al Horford pick and pop opportunities. And so I think especially when it bogs down in the half court, they should try that as well and, you know, see what they can do in that regard. But I mean, this is a Bulls team with guys like Rondo and Wade, who is much more engaged defensively than they had been.
Yeah. And something we talked about on the Twitter NBA show Second Screen, which was a lot of fun today, was the odds of Boston actually winning this series. And I mean, it's amazing to think about, considering I think both of us. Okay, well, actually, let's start here instead of going to the odds, because that's kind of a way to close this segment. I think you were the same way. We were both lower on Boston just in terms of their overall profile, but I felt a lot more comfortable with their chances of advancing because of how little I thought of Chicago. And it's turned out that the first part of that analysis was more accurate than the second part, which is not the way I expected this to go.
Yeah, I mean, and there'll be plenty of time for this, but, you know, if the Bulls win this series and Boston loses, I mean, what a change that would be for the free agent plans for both of these teams.
Can we have an agreement that if that happens, that we do maybe we do Boston offseason previews twice, but we do one, like, a short one that night? Because I just think that would be so much fun to just have that discussion right at the time.
No, I mean, I think usually the schedule is that we try and do it right after the team has been eliminated. I mean, that's when there's going to be the most interest in that, obviously, so that seems like a good idea. And a few other notes here before we move on. Paul Zipser at the four was outstanding. I mean, he's looking like a pretty darn good second round pick right now. I mean, to have this kind of a contribution in a playoff game. The Bulls' steals and their 23 points off turnovers were huge. Getting out on the break were huge for the Bulls. That's not something that they really did that much. 12 steals, Rondo and Butler combining for 9. That was huge. They really just made the Celtics look kind of desperate in that fourth quarter. And Avery Bradley even said that, like, their body language wasn't good. They were forcing it. Rondo was even saying on the court, hey, they're defeated, they've given up, which, you know, is quite self-serving. It must be very satisfying for Rondo as well to go back to Boston Garden, to the team that traded him away, kind of started what he probably views as the decline of his career, and to be effective there. So that's been great. And then Rondo made the point in post-game interviews, Fred Hoiberg did a great job preparing us, and I got nothing to argue with on that. I mean, Fred Hoiberg, you know, I don't want to say that, like, Stevens has been making a bunch of mistakes, but Stevens has definitely been scrambling. The Celtics have been playing like the underdog, really, in this series. And, you know, Fred Hoiberg has really had the Midas touch so far.
He absolutely has. And one other part of the story from this game, which is so different from game one, is that in game one, Chicago absolutely killed Boston on the offensive glass. And they did have 11 offensive rebounds in this game, but Boston also had 11. So what had been a big advantage was negated, and Boston still lost by 14.
Yeah, and the Bulls winning the turnover battle, that's something that the Celtics can't have. I mean, Rondo is usually a turnover machine, and the Celtics 16 turnovers, Bulls 10. And just like Dwayne Wade was fantastic. The Bulls hit a lot of hard shots, and they hit a lot of hard shots in game one. But, you know, I mean, I think another thing, that's the Celtics were this great clutch team all year, and they've gotten waxed in the clutch in the fourth quarter of both of these games, to the point where there didn't even end up being a clutch, frankly. Also, Jimmy Butler has had like 3 or 4 emphatic blocks of Isaiah Thomas at the rim in this series, and they kind of take on just like a mini version of LeBron blocking Steph Curry in the finals a bunch of times last year, to just say, hey, you know what, like, I know you had this great season and you're all skilled and you're a great story and stuff, but hey, I'm way bigger than you and I'm gonna block your shot. So last thing I wanted to talk about here, this is something that Slater asked us when he was kind enough to join us for the Twitter NBA show today, but I wanted us both to expand it a little bit. How now, with this issue, does it look Boston not making any kind of a move whatsoever at the trade deadline to bolster this team? And I'm not even talking about, you know, making a move for Butler or Paul George, putting all their chips in on that. I'm talking about, you know, not even making a smaller move for a big who can play.
That part is a little bit more irksome to me than the first part, because, you know, the bigger story, and I don't want to step on your toes because I thought you had a great point on that on Twitter NBA show, and if you want to remake it, I have no issues with that. But considering the price that was given up for Taj Gibson, which was, you know, Cameron Payne, which, yeah, Chicago really liked Cameron Payne for some reason, and also Nerlens Noel was a very low price for him. Boston, we focus on their high-end assets, and their high-end assets are wonderful. They also have good low-end assets. They could have traded their own first-round pick next year, and that probably would have been better than a lot of what was on that, than for Nerlens and a few of the other things. So I think if they could have pulled that off, like a low-end thing, then it's kind of the best of both worlds in that way. But you might be right that this was not the time for a bigger move, and that they might have actually dodged a bullet by that.
Yeah, my thinking was you can make the argument, and I know Bontemps has said, hey, they should have made more of a move. I mean, I think what they really even need is one more guy who can play on the wing and hit some shots. You know, I mean, Marcus Smart trying to play the three, I mean, they're undersized at every position, as we talked about on Sunday night's show. But if they really are at this level where they can't even beat the Bulls in a series, and it sure isn't looking great right now on that score, if they're really at that level, then it's hard to say that, hey, throwing all our chips in to get Jimmy Butler or Paul George would have gotten us into championship contention. That's the only way you make that move, especially when you consider that George could leave after next year. And so maybe this is a wake-up call that, you know, this team has overachieved in the regular season, but this team was never supposed to be a number one seed type of team. You know, they're supposed to have these Brooklyn picks. They're supposed to tank in 2014 and get Andrew Wiggins or Jabari Parker. And now they're really good through a lot of kind of small moves and great development of players, you know, getting guys like Crowder and Thomas in trade, Avery Bradley developing, being a good enough team that they could then get Al Horford to sign with them, all that to get to this point. But, you know, this is still maybe not a team that's got the type of talent where we're really one player away. And learning that lesson might be a good idea to say, hey, you know what, we're going to hold on to these Brooklyn picks. We're going to try to get three top five picks in a row, add them to a solid team, and have a foundation to be a good team for the next 10 years instead of throwing all our chips in and then, you know, having one or two years where we're quasi contenders, but not really huge contenders. Maybe this is like needed information to disabuse any delusions of grandeur for this group, which after all only had a 2.5 net rating this year.
It's also worth mentioning how big a leap it is from the number one seed part isn't that big deal, but winning a championship, if that is their goal, is a big, big step from where they were this year and where they were last year. And you could argue that the number one pick, if they hit on it, is enough, but they were at the precipice. I've been talking about this for 2 years now, of having this bad piece of timing where their key pieces now are going to age out before the young pieces can replace them. And so you can do that if you want to stay consistently relevant, and there are teams that define success that way. But if they want to win a championship, doing what they almost did and going after those kind of guys might have actually made it a lot harder for that duel to happen.
You know, and it's funny because you see Jaylen Brown out there, and he has the physical ability to be a player who could really help in this series, but he doesn't have the experience yet. He doesn't have the trust level to try and do stuff with the ball in his hands yet, from the coaching staff or probably for himself even. You know, if you could give me Jaylen Brown 2 years from now and plug him into this team, it looks a whole lot different, right? But, you know, got even top three picks take time before they're ready to contribute to winning basketball. All right, so now what is your feeling on the series? What percent chance would you give Boston of somehow turning it around? They would need to, of course, win four of the next five, and three of those five games will be in Chicago.
I think I said 15% when we were asked that kind of off the cuff. I think I'd have it, yeah, 15 to 20%. Chicago, I still fall back on my prior to a solid degree with them. I mean, they sure played incredibly recently, and they have shown an innate ability to defy expectations at basically every single turn. So that, in this case, would probably be losing game three, maybe even game four as well. But they've been the better team for these two games. So I think that you kind of want to rely on all that stuff. And so for me, when you bake all that in, you get around 15 to 20%.
Yeah, and frankly, Rondo has been like this good for 2 months now. After he got benched, basically was nearly out of the rotation. He was out of the rotation for a while, was playing backup point guard for a while. He got brought in as a starter, and he's been playing like this other than the time that he missed from this wrist injury, which apparently is not bothering him despite the fact that they termed it as significant damage. I mean, you know, I don't think Robin Lopez can continue to play this well. You know, he does have some limitations, and I think, you know, the Celtics need to find a way to start taking advantage of some of the limitations. But, you know, these older Bulls players, Rondo and Wade in particular, are playing a lot harder, and the Bulls young players who have been so maligned, Mirotić, Portis, Felicio, Zipser, all those guys were kind of deemed to be pretty much non-entities, and those guys have all played well. Can they all continue to do that? I don't know. I mean, this is obviously a Bulls team that has had, over the last couple of years, a lot of highs. They've beat some very good teams and lost to some bad teams as well. But, you know, I mean, it's obviously a must win in game three. We'll see what we get from the Celtics here. And, you know, it's with Isaiah, he's got to go back to Tacoma now, obviously, to be with his family. He's expected to rejoin the team for game three. And there's a little bit of that dynamic as well. It's going to be very difficult for the Celtics team. I mean, I would give them, you know, maybe a 20% chance just because, you know, the Bulls are so inconsistent, and because, you know, I think the Celtics can play better, especially defensively. I think that the way they've gotten beaten by this Bulls team on offense, you know, the Bulls can't continue to shoot this well, like on mid-range jumpers like they did. So let's take it to a commercial break here. We are brought to you today by our friends at Hubble Contacts. I know a lot of people overwear their contacts lenses to save money. They are, and that's because they're needlessly expensive. And it's just like a little piece of plastic, right? Like, why does it need to be so expensive? It's basically a commodity. Well, contacts are expensive because four companies currently control 97% of the market. And then, of course, you get in through your optometrist, someone sells it to them. There ends up being a huge markup for something that costs like nothing to really to manufacture. You've already got your prescription. That's what the actual work is. There are, you know, millions of contacts with all kinds of prescriptions made all the time. Like, it's just a piece of plastic. It shouldn't cost as much as it does. So what if I told you that Hubble Contacts is changing that? You're going to have a fresh pair of lenses for every single day, $30 a month, $1 a day. Of course, that's half the price of other brands. And they are just as good, if not better quality than those four companies that control 97% of the market, as proven by a study at the University of Houston Optometry School. And putting in a fresh pair of contacts every day is really just a great feeling for your tired eyes. So if you want to watch the Twitter NBA show and see Danny and I in just absolute perfect clarity, Hubble Contacts is the way to go. I actually ordered them for my girlfriend. It's extremely easy. You put in your prescription and you're done in like 90 seconds. They send it to you. It's pretty incredible. So if you want to get started with them, you can get your first 2 weeks of lenses for free. Go to HubbleContacts.com. 15 pairs of lenses for free, an unbeatable deal. Give it a shot. Get 20/20 vision for half the price. That's HubbleContacts.com. HubbleContacts.com. All right, let's move on to the other East game here. Milwaukee and Toronto. Kyle Lowry with a bounce back game, the key story here.
Right. I mean, I think you can go with a couple different big takeaways, but one of them is Kyle Lowry having a good game is important for the Raptors. 22 points, 6 of 12 from the field, 2 of 5 from 3. One of those threes was early. He only did have 5 assists and 4 turnovers, but this game was not typified by, you know, the starters beasting the starters. I think they were pretty close to even during those minutes, and then the Lowry plus bench unit had one better stretch than the other. But the other element to me of this game, and I talked about this on the fly, and it has only crystallized with some of the later action, was the narrative of this would be very different if a few shots had gone the other way, and they were all about the same quality. You could argue that the shot takers were different quality, but Lowry's shot was a lot tougher than some of the attempts that Milwaukee had in the final minute, and all of those went wanting.
Yeah, let's talk about that final minute here. It was tied at 100, and as you mentioned, Toronto did their usual, as Bill Simmons would say, clogged toilet late game offense, where they got into actions pretty late in the clock. And however, they did get two DeMar DeRozan jump shots, one of which he made, which was quite contested by poor Malcolm Brogdon. He missed another one. Their other possession down the stretch was two missed PJ Tucker free throws after a terrible over the backbreaker foul by Giannis with 56 seconds left, down two. And then, of course, there was that amazing Lowry shot where they ran the clock down up by two, and then he drove and stepped back to his left, and it was as good a contest as you're ever going to get for Malcolm Brogdon, and didn't matter. Lowry drained it, a huge shot for him. He usually plays well in these game twos after they lose game ones, of course. And so those were Toronto's four possessions in the last 2 minutes. And then Milwaukee got a wide open three from Malcolm Brogdon off a nice little pick and pop action, where they miscommunicated. Matthew Dellavedova had a wide open three off a great pass from Thon Maker, who closed the game. We'll talk more about that. He couldn't hit that. And then Middleton had to take a really bad three after Giannis got double teamed in the post. Actually, DeRozan had a great closeout. He double teamed Giannis, forced a pass, and then closed out on Middleton. Not something you'll say often about DeMar DeRozan, but we'll give him some credit on when he does make a nice play. So the Bucks clearly had higher expected value on their shots down the end. It's just they didn't go in, you know, make or miss league.
It is, and you have to also give credit to some guys are good shot makers, and Lowry didn't have those go in the first game, but he certainly did here. And let's go back to Thon Maker, because while he wasn't the best player on the floor for Milwaukee, you know, Giannis had a solid game, not nearly as remarkable as game one, but I thought Thon was a more consistent positive than I expected. And I mean, you think back to those, even though they were plus two in that, but the minutes that Toledovich played, the minutes that Spencer Hawes played, they were plus two with Hawes, -9 with Toledovich, and Thon Maker deserves the minutes that he got in that second half more so than basically the Keith Bogans in the first.
Yeah, I agree, especially when it relates to Hawes. Although Hawes actually wasn't bad in a Milwaukee stint in which they staged a nice little comeback at the end of the half. But yeah, I think that Thon's spacing was important, although he was only 2 out of 7, and he did have one dunk blocked in spectacular fashion by Serge Ibaka, who actually was awesome. But his spacing was key to them getting some pretty good shots down the end, and they're able to get Giannis going to the rim or Middleton and then kick out a lot of times. So that was good. And he, with some fine pick and roll defense as well, earned that spot over Greg Monroe, though Monroe was outstanding from a scoring perspective at 18 points on in only 22 minutes and took only 12 shooting possessions to get his 18 points, but he got lit up on defense a little bit. I think Thon should play more. I mean, just play those two guys, Maker and Monroe, together and don't bother with Hawes. One interesting thing here as well, the shooting chart for the Bucks and Giannis in particular, only 5 of 11 at the rim. You never see Giannis do that poorly. The Bucks actually caused him a lot of problems at the rim, and then he was a further 0 for 3 in the paint outside of the restricted area. And I thought Serge Ibaka was just a massive presence defending the rim. I mean, he played 36 minutes, was plus 13, the only player on either team in double figures in the plus minus, 16 points, hit 4 three-pointers in the second half to help space the floor, and he played much of it at center. And Serge even had 6 assists as well. I mean, you remember when people were like, oh, you know, they just ISO all the time in OKC because Serge, you can't trust him with the ball. Well, you know, he had a great pass along the baseline to set up a dunk at one point for Valanciunas in early in the second half. Like, he was really fantastic and making Masai Ujiri look real smart for trading for him.
One of the other dualities you talked about is defense, which was central to a couple of big moments in this game. But there was a time, I think it was particularly the Lowry plus bench unit, early in the second and then early in the fourth quarter, where those lineups were actually getting reliably open shots. And in the first quarter, PJ Tucker, I think, missed 2 threes. Serge Ibaka missed at least one. And then in the second half, that fourth quarter, those basically the same looks went in. And so it kind of balanced out, but that put Toronto in the place that they kind of should have been the whole time, which was generating good looks and converting them. And then that helped give them the fuel to basically hold on, even though the Bucks did end up tying the game.
Yeah, Maker was so important because that defense really for Toronto, and I apologize for being a bit Houstonian, but I looked this up too, 12 of 25 overall at the rim, which is for the Bucks. They usually like to get to the rim a lot more. And then 3 of 14 in the paint non-restricted area, which they made difficult as well. So even though the Bucks, both teams shot nearly 50% on threes, the two-point shooting was not quite there for the Bucks. And I expect Giannis to bounce back a little bit, especially when he has a little bit more space on the floor. But yeah, I mean, I thought that Toronto's process was a little bit better. You know, you're not going to get 3 out of 4 three-point shooting from Corey Joseph every game, you know, that kind of thing.
I just thought of something that you talked about, the process that we should have talked about early on. We focused on it a lot on this Twitter NBA show, which was Toronto's strategy to attack Milwaukee's aggressive pick and roll coverage was to short the pick and roll. And they generated a lot of really good looks out of that because they created an easier pass and created opportunities, including some nice run for Jakob Poeltl in the first half.
Yeah, and that was clearly the strategy. We had talked about how Milwaukee was difficult to play against, but you know, there are things that you can do against their traps. And shorting the pick and roll, we've talked about that before, but as a refresher, basically what that is you set a pick and roll a lot of times on one side of the floor and knowing that they're going to trap it, and it's difficult to thread that needle through to the roll guy. So instead, they bring a guy up towards the top of the key. You have the passing angle while you're being trapped to him, and now you can throw it to the roll guy who's taken off early and slip that screen. That was the one layup that Poeltl had, for example. Monroe was not able to get back into the play fast enough. They took advantage of his lack of mobility, although of course he's been better this season. So yeah, and that was something where it was pretty much every time they'd start a pick and roll, and I really thought that they did a very good job overall trying to reverse the ball quickly. And I think Milwaukee kind of started to figure it out a little bit, because on a lot of these possessions too, the play was, all right, we'll just run kind of a fake pick and roll here with Lowry on one side, and then we'll reverse the ball to DeRozan coming off a screen on the other side and let him attack. And so Milwaukee, I think, started to suss out when, you know, that was more of a dummy action and didn't trap it as hard. But, you know, I thought it was a good adjustment from Toronto in game two, and we'll see now whether the Bucks can respond defensively. Toronto really struggled to score against them, but it wouldn't surprise me if Toronto hasn't kind of figured out this Milwaukee defense a little bit.
538 currently has this series as 60-40 for Toronto. I actually would have Toronto's odds higher than that, probably around 70-75%.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see, I guess Toronto won't be at home in the next series, no matter what. So, well, unless Indiana comes back and wins, which they're not going to. So we won't get to see whether unless they play the Bulls in the conference finals.
Or the Wizards.
Or the Wizards for that matter. That's right. But we won't get to see whether their game one jinx applies or not, probably. probably for the rest of the year. A few other notes here. You mentioned Teletovic was -9. He just has been unplayable defensively. Has looked really bad. And it's tough for Kidd because Giannis played 42 minutes in this one. I don't think you want to play him any more than that. They got to get at least something at backup power forward. I mean, maybe you even think about running with Thon as your backup power forward at this point. I think he might be able to give you more with his mobility and shot blocking. And, you know, Teletovic hasn't been able to make a shot either. So maybe they could try that out a little bit. Patrick Patterson played a lot more, which although he wasn't exactly like on fire and he had a foot injury scare that he was able to return from, he played 30 minutes. He only played 16 in game one. And I thought that was very important just to get more spacing on the floor, more defense. They closed actually with Tucker at the three, Patterson at the four, and Ibaka at the five. And that I thought was a pretty quality defensive lineup. I mean, you've got four very good defenders in there along with DeRozan, who actually, you know, gave some pretty good effort himself, as we noted.
Another contributor for the Raptors, which was a surprise considering he wasn't a factor in game one, was DeLon Wright. I thought DeLon Wright looked good out there. He played 8 minutes, didn't score, but had a couple of nice passes and was a more capable defender because he's bigger.
Yeah, that was good. Norman Powell did not play at all. We speculated that he might play. Instead, Joseph gave them a lot more, as we said. They also did not really target because Joseph wasn't in the game late. You know, they didn't have a chance to target him. I mean, that's another nice thing about going with that bigger lineup as well. So yeah, I thought that Wright was good. You know, he had some quick hands. It is tough. You know, they're playing he and Joseph together for a time. They're playing Wright and DeRozan together. DeRozan had a few more record scratches in this one. So did Giannis, you know, from 3-point range. But yeah, playing Wright is tough because he's just a total non-shooter from three. And I think he's a guy who, if you're not expecting him to come in, he can give you some energy for a short burst. But, you know, if he's on the scouting report, he's probably going to grow to be a little bit more ineffective. And also, I want to say I was very impressed by PJ Tucker's release from the 3-point line. He looks to have really gotten better since his Phoenix days, especially early on in his Phoenix career. His shot is much faster now. He can shoot without his feet perfectly set. He gets his shot off quickly. You know, it may not go in all the time, but I think the fact that he's just willing to shoot it quickly with confidence requires more of a closeout. And then, of course, you know, I thought he was excellent defensively, a key part in holding Giannis to that 9-24 shooting.
Anything else in this game? I think that's about it.
Now let's move on to... Oh yeah, actually I did have one more thing too. This game was really just like quite entertaining just in the sense that there are a bunch of runs. You know, it was basically, it seemed like the Raps would go up 10 and then the Bucks would immediately respond and get it close again. So the Bucks in this game had runs of 9-0, 11-0, 15-4, 17-5. And the Raptors had runs of 7-0, 18-2, 11-0, and then they closed the game 6-0. Although two of those were intentional foul free throws at the end. So it really was entertaining. You kept feeling like, all right, you know, the Raptors game two, they're moon away. And there has been some research. Ben Falk talked about this on his site that, you know, the team that loses game one at home is just overwhelmingly much more likely to win game two as opposed to the team that wins game one at home than in game two. I mean, I think there is something to this idea that you're just desperate now in game two, and maybe there's some overconfidence after game one as well. But, you know, there's just, it seems like there's a principle here that, you know, the team that loses a game one is much more likely to win in game two than they would be kind of ordinarily, which is an interesting principle to think about.
Sorry, Boston.
Well, but how do teams that lose the first two games doing game three? Probably not that great, actually. So Clippers in Utah, the first thing that occurred to me in this game, to be honest, you know, it was a hard fought competitive game, slow pace with Utah, is that especially with Rudy Gobert out, these are actually two pretty flawed team. And I say that because the Clippers just don't have enough shooting, and, you know, they can be taken advantage of when they do try to get enough shooting on the floor. And then Utah, of course, just doesn't quite have the offensive firepower or now anybody who can really defend at the rim and provide much competence also. I mean, Derek Favors is playing gamely, but he was always an inadequate rim protector as a center, much better as a power forward, certainly. But, you know, they need him at center. He's their only guy who can do anything on offense at center now. And the Clippers just completely destroyed them. 15 of 17 in the paint in the first half. And remember, you know, the average team shoots about 25 shots in the paint for the game and shoots about 60%. So they shot 80% and they had way higher volume as well. And then for the game, 80% shooting, 27 out of 34 in the restricted area for the Clippers. And that's really where they won the game, because Utah just could not protect the rim. And it's not like the Clippers were shooting a bunch of threes stretching the floor. You know, they're helping off in Mbamute. They had a bunch of bodies in there, you know, and it didn't matter. They just kept pounding it in. DeAndre Jordan, I thought, really was the most important player for the Clippers tonight.
Yeah, for the most part he was, especially with Chris Paul dealing with...
He had seven dunks in this game.
Well, and especially with Chris Paul missing a lot of time early due to foul trouble. So they needed somebody who could basically... And DeAndre created their identity. And usually that's CP with them. And I think my overall take with this game was that it was what I expected game one to be after Rudy Gobert got out.
Right.
The Jazz, you know, they had some offensive moments. They had some things. I thought Rodney Hood had a few good moments in this game too. But they couldn't really put it together enough offensively. And then defensively, they lost their point of most of greatest resistance. And it just so happens that that point of greatest resistance for them was also incredibly potent against the Clippers, because due to their lack of spacing, they get opportunities at the rim. And without Gobert there, probably the best rim protector in the league, it seemed like they were going to be able to get opportunities there. And that's exactly what ended up happening, where not only was it DeAndre Jordan with his seven dunks, Blake Griffin with a few, as Anthony Slater would say, vintage moments. I would disagree, but anyway. And then, you know, but it was other guys too. You know, Chris Paul had a couple of finishes. Luke Richard Mbamute had the best layup I think I've ever seen him make. Was a kind of a tough wrong-footed layup. And other guys were able to get in there too, just because there wasn't as much resistance, even if there was personnel.
You know, it's funny because seeing how limited the Clippers are in terms of, you know, other than just Chris Paul mid-rangers, Blake Griffin mid-rangers, and then just like, you know, plowing in into the rim and trying to score. If Rudy Gobert were in, I think this Clippers team actually would be like in big trouble trying to score against these guys. Now, you know, Redick and Crawford are going to shoot better. You know, that's a component. But with Mbamute playing 38 minutes, I realized that he's been excellent on Gordon Hayward, who struggled to a 5 of 15 shooting night, but did get to the foul line a little bit. But, you know, Hayward still struggling with Mbamute's ability to get over the screen and bother his shot from behind. So, but with Mbamute not having to be guarded and Rudy Gobert in there as well, I mean, I think it would be really interesting to see what would happen if they just had Gobert guard Mbamute at some point when he comes back. And there does appear to be some optimism that he could make it back by the end if it's a long series, although, you know, whether he'd be in shape, how well he'd play, I mean, all that is, you know, very, very questionable. I think they also missed Rudy's vertical spacing, and they missed his ability on the offensive glass. He only had 3 offensive rebounds, which is, you know, really bad for when you're playing at a slow pace. You got to try
and they struggled. They struggled to score in the paint as well, and that's something Gobert can really help with, just because he's such a good roller that whether he's getting those looks or something else, he just draws attention. He's not the gravity player as a role man that DeAndre Jordan is, but he can certainly provide some of that, and it helps create openings for everybody else.
That's right. I mean, and now you're not forcing Mbamute, for example, on the weak side of a pick and roll to have help responsibilities on a Gobert roll, and now you swing it to Hayward, and he can get a running start because Mbamute had to crash down in the lane. You don't really have that kind of an element, or you don't have JJ Redick or Jamal Crawford trying to come in from the weak side and stop Gobert's role. So, I mean, there's a reason Gobert is, you know, probably a top 25 player in the league. And while Favors has, I think, been pretty solid offensively, he's had some nice finishes inside. He's just not the player that Gobert is defensively, and he doesn't get up the way Gobert does on lobs for pick and rolls either. So, you know, I think that game three to me is going to decide the series. You know, I could very easily see if the Clips win game three that, you know, we're probably going to be done in five, or maybe, you know, a not as competitive six. I mean, this one just seemed kind of inevitable. And we haven't mentioned the name Chris Paul yet. I mean, he in the two fourth quarters now, he has 19 points, very efficient. And, you know, the Jazz just had no answers for him. They were contesting him, but he still was just able to snake the pick and roll and get to his right and shoot that free throw line or elbow jumper fading away to his right every time. And just, you know, he makes it.
And he's also a zealous defender. I thought that he was a big point, positive point at the point of attack in a lot of those circumstances. And then offensively, he knows what he's doing. He knows how to not only put himself in positions to succeed right around the nail, but also for teammates. And, you know, his threat as a lob, you know, passer is incredibly important to the Clippers. And he was the best player on the floor in that fourth quarter. And he should be, because I think he's the best player in this series. I think I had him fourth or fifth in the league, so I certainly should.
A few big shots. George Hill had a three-pointer that was wide open in transition off a steal that he missed really badly that could have cut it to three and maybe made things a little bit different. And then Paul, off a switch, his favorite move when he's isolated is to, in the late clock against a big, is he'll pick the ball up, and as he's picking it up, just take two two giant steps, which is legal as you're gathering the ball, either to his left or his right. This time he did it to his right, just in the dead corner against Boris Dia, drained a three, and then Blake Griffin had a huge three as well that basically that put the Clips up nine the last couple of minutes, which was pretty well contested also. But yeah, I mean, the whole vintage Blake Griffin thing, he had himself a nice game with 24 points in this one, 11 of 21 from the field. But, you know, he was still being guarded pretty adequately by Joe Johnson. Boris Dia is another story, but, you know, vintage Blake Griffin, as it were, Joe Johnson would have no chance against him. He would just go through him and dunk every time. And Blake, you know, doesn't have that level of athleticism anymore. One other thing I thought was really interesting, up until the Jazz fouled intentionally at the very end of the game, the Clippers somehow, despite taking those millions of shots in the paint, shot only six free throws for the whole game. And in particular, there are a bunch of plays for the Jazz. I know Favors, as really their only center, didn't want to get in foul trouble, but, you know, DeAndre Jordan was 0 for 3 from the free throw line, and he had eight dunks. You know, someone needs to foul him in there.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We thought we might see Hacka in this game. We did not.
Yeah, I mean, especially when they were down by, you know, 6 points, 9 points, and this is a Jazz team that I think is uniquely well-suited for that because they don't rely on transition at all. They can get more of their offensive players on the floor, too, if they're going to be fouling. You know, but with down six, down nine, where they're kind of fluctuating with 5 minutes left in the game, I think you do try to extend it by fouling Jordan. They're used to playing in the late clock anyway against a set defense, so it's not as much of a concern for them, the fact that, you know, you're not going to be as good offensively.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
When you're going against a set defense.
I also want to mention, you talked about the shot that Hill missed that was important. Gordon Hayward had at least one shot that could have put the lead down to three as well.
Yeah, he airballed a wide open 3-2. Yeah, you're right about that. So, I mean, I think this is kind of what we expected, and, you know, maybe the hope has got to be for the Jazz that they can get one of these next two in Salt Lake City. I don't see any circumstances in which they can get both of them, but they got to get at least one in Salt Lake City, and then maybe by game five, Rudy Gobert can come back and just give them enough as a presence around the rim that, you know, they can pull a huge upset in game five in LA. So I think that'll do it for tonight.
There's one piece of news, just because I don't think it's important enough that we need to focus it in another piece, is that the tiebreakers for the NBA draft were today.
Oh yeah, no, we got to talk about that. Thank you. We got to talk about the KD injury too. Yeah.
What order do you want to do those?
Well, I think the KD injury first. You know, I'm sure you just recorded on this on Locked On Warriors, but just out of nowhere, Durant had been kind of futzing with his calf, but, you know, had a great end to that game one, and then has not practiced the last 2 days. Yesterday was an optional workout day, and today was a full practice. So he's questionable. Sean Livingston also questionable, as is Matt Barnes, for the next game. But Durant, the bigger concern, calf injuries, as we know, can linger.
They certainly can, and I advocated on that podcast for patience with him, just because a game now, if that even was the circumstance, is far less significant to them than something moving forward. And these injuries have a habit sometimes of becoming something larger if you push it a little bit too hard. I think back also to, you know, Chris Paul's hamstring thing, and there are a couple other calf strains. I'm sure you probably have memory of some specifically where they pushed a little bit too hard and then it became a bigger thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, like Jamal Crawford at the end of I think like two seasons ago was one example of that, where he just kept kind of messing up his calf. And, you know, you got to use your calf a bunch of times, and it's really, I mean, I've had a million calf injuries just playing myself, and it's really weird to have it because you can kind of move around, but you're just, every time you jump, you're sort of just like, all right, how high can I jump without making this hurt, you know? And so you can never quite jump full out, and you feel like you could move around, but then it's just always in the back of your mind, and you have to kind of play a little bit more conservatively. And it would surprise me if they don't hold him out, to be honest, because, and then they may make noise about how he's about to play right up until tip-off. That would be, you know, kind of what their pattern has been, but they have plenty of firepower against this Portland team that doesn't have Nurkic. They played so incredibly well when KD was out, you know, still really best level of the best team in the league easily. I mean, remember, they beat San Antonio on the road, they beat OKC on the road, they beat Houston on the road, all those quite comfortably. So I think they feel very confident that they could just win this game too without KD. They got another 2 days off after this game, either have him come back. But I will say, you know, if a calf strain is bad enough that a guy, you know, can't practice, I mean, it's hard to imagine where you kind of miss just one game. You don't see that very often. I mean, Mahimi is in that situation too. At least he was able to finish the game. This wasn't so bad that he had to just leave, which is encouraging. So, I mean, I think this is the type of thing where, you know, just sit him out for a game or two, hope he can come back, and hope that this isn't something where where he's, you know, the result of compensation for this knee injury. But yeah, I think he's looked good so far, and don't ruin it. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth and just, you know, sit him unless he's just like feels great. But I mean, it's hard. It's if he couldn't practice today, I don't know if it would be possible for it to heal enough in one day for me to say, hey, you know, he should definitely play for sure in a game that, you know, is not meaningless, but, you know, it's kind of it's not meaningless, but
his presence could be overcome. His absence can be overcome.
Thank you. Yeah. I put that poorly. So what do we got in terms of the lottery ties being broken? This is always one of your favorites.
It is.
Thank you for interrupting me to get to it as I tried to end the show. I knew that was one where you knew you had to speak up because I'm sure you were foaming at the mouth to get to this particular topic.
Well, it wasn't as fun this year because the lottery, the protections on picks weren't affected by this in a direct way, but it's still interesting. So basically in the lottery, how it works is that you combine those teams' odds, and then really how the coin flip is important is if neither team jumps into the top three. And so the most important of the coin flips was the 6-7. Minnesota was originally in 7 by themselves, but then the New York Knicks won against the Sixers on the last day of the season and one of the more entertaining Twitter NBA shows we've ever done. And so then that led to it being a coin flip. Minnesota won the coin flip, so now if neither team moves up, they get the 6th pick, New York gets the 7th pick. That is by far the most important one. Do you want me to run through the other ones, or do you want to talk about that one first?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, especially that four-way tie of teams at 51 and 31. I mean, that's a lot of slots for some
right.
of these teams.
So that was the only actual coin flip in the lottery. Then there were four other big ones outside of that. 15-16, Portland won, so Portland will pick 15, and then Chicago will pick 16. Then the next two picks were also a coin flip. Milwaukee is 17, Indiana is 18, and then the next two picks are also a coin flip. That's Atlanta and Portland. So Portland won one of those coin flips and lost the second one, but then there's there was a big four-way tie.
Portland pick, by the way, from Memphis.
Correct.
And originally came from Denver.
The Nurkic.
Can we call it ill-fated yet? Mason Plumlee trade?
Well, it was not ill-fated for Portland.
They got the 19th pick. And actually, that pick ended up being probably more valuable than it looked at the time of the trade because Memphis really kind of swooned from a record standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So they got the 19th pick. 20th pick and Nurkic for soon-to-be restricted free agent Mason Plumlee.
So then the last one was a tiebreaker for four teams picking 23 to 26. And the way that ended up shaking out is Toronto won it, so they're picking 23rd. Utah finished second, so they're picking 24th. Orlando is picking 25th, and Portland is picking 26th. And the other part that's really interesting about that is Toronto has their own pick, because originally you're thinking, oh, it's not that big a difference, because if Toronto, you know, maybe they would have the 26th pick, because then they gave Orlando the worst of their two picks for Serge Ibaka. Now that's a four-pick difference. It's 27 versus 23. That's far different than it was than those who perceived it as being like 26 versus 27. And I think that might have been a piece of Rob Hennigan's negotiation. I mean, considering everybody knew those picks were going to be close, to just say, hey, give us the better one. I think that Orlando would not, I mean, Toronto would not have blanched at that.
Yeah. And obviously that Ibaka trade is looking pretty good. You know, it's not like Terrence Ross has killed it really for Orlando either. And he's kind of certainly a tough fit in that starting lineup with Fournier. So yeah, that's a good point. And for Cleveland, I mean, they ended up at the back of that group. You know, that's kind of a big deal for them as well, as they try to replenish. I mean, that getting like, you know, higher up there in the early 20s could have been really useful for them. You know, a team that is considered by many the second best in basketball, it could have at least been like one nice little benefit of like how crappy their season was from a record standpoint, but they really are not getting nearly as much of the benefit of that due to the result of this coin flip.
Oh, small correction. I flubbed up a little bit myself. The difference between the better and worse picks, it's 23 versus 25, not 23 versus 27. So it is still a difference, but I mean, they could have negotiated that anyway.
Yeah, no, and good job there by UG. All right, now are we done, Danny?
Yes.
All right, sounds good. Thanks everyone for listening. We will not be doing Twitter NBA show on Wednesday due to the Warriors home game, but we will of course be live tweeting, and we will of course also be back with a Dunked On wrap up pretty late at night, since we got to go back and actually watch the other games. But it will be out for the games tomorrow night. Don't forget about our sponsor today, Hubble Contacts. You can get 15 free pairs at Hubble Contacts by going to hubblecontacts.com. Talk to y'all next time.